G'day world, you're listening to Cameron Riley on the podcast network, recorded March the 20th. March the 20th. My watch says the 17th, so something's going on there. Of 2009, and my guest here with me is Dr. Peter Elliard, author of Designing 2050, Pathways to a Sustainable Future. Is that what the
Pathways to Sustainable Prosperity on
prosperity
Spaceship
Earth. Prosperity on Spaceship Earth. That's right.
Putting sustainability and prosperity are actually important part of it.
Peter, why don't you, for people that haven't heard you on the show before, why don't you tell us about your background for 60 seconds?
I'm a futurist who's done a lot of work in the environment, run two environment departments. I was the head of the Commission for the Future as well as that. I was the CEO of the Minister's Office in Canberra in the environment. So I've worked in the environment since 1971, and I'm the first person working in the environment in the whole of Australia. And I worked, amongst other things, on creating the Framework Convention on Climate Change in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. So I've been involved, and I now work as a futurist and strategist. So I look ahead, and my new book is called Designing 2050, which is all about the year 2050 and how we're going to fix the world up and make it a sustainably prosperous society, planet-wise, by the year 2050.
So you're not one of these people that's just jumped on the environment bandwagon since Al Gore's film came out?
Not at all. I was way before when Al Gore was even thinking about that. So I actually was – when I became – I worked for the Australian Senate – in 1970, and I wrote a report on water pollution for the Senate. There were no environment ministers and no environment departments at all in the whole country. So I was actually had the first job, certainly in the public sector, and probably leaving out soil conservation organisations in Australia. I'd just come back from America where I'd studied, and quite soon after that I worked in the Research Service at Parliament House and as the first appointed person on the environmental policy. And then later on I went to the Environment Department in Canberra and as Chief Executive of the staff of the Environment Minister, of the Office of the Environment Minister in Canberra between 72 and 75.
So they had an Environment Minister?
We did indeed. And a part of my work is I set up the Heritage Commission and the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority. We put through the first bill on environment impact statements in Australia. They were legacies of that time, and there were a lot of others too. Signed up all the wetlands conventions, the Ramsey's Convention. We did a huge number of things. We were the first really significant environment department in the country, certainly nationally, and we did a whole lot of things which, by and large, are still on the books. After that, I went to Papua New Guinea, and I was the founding head of the environment department there.
And you were involved with the UN as well?
All through this, I've been an advisor of the UN Environment Program, the UN Development Program, and UNESCO. I still am.
And what was that thing that they did in the early 90s, Earth Day or something like that?
Well, we have an Earth Day, but there's two Earth Days. There was the World Environment Day is now that's now taken over, which is the June the 5th. And that commemorates the fact that in 1972, on the 5th of June, the UN Conference on the Human Environment started in Stockholm. And I was there as an advisor to that, to Maurice Strong, who was the first CEO of that. He was the CEO of the Earth Summit 20 years later in 92. He was the founder of the UN Environment Program between those two, and he's been a close friend and colleague of mine all these years.
So I wanted to get you on the show again today. You've been on the show a lot of times in the past. We've talked about a lot of different things, but there's been, I guess in the last week, there has been the Interplanetary Climate
the IPCC.
Council. Is that what the IPCC stands for? Something like that? Have been meeting, and from the reports I've been reading out of that, they sound more pessimistic than ever about the data that they're seeing. From some of the stuff that I read, they're saying that the data shows that our situation is even worse than their worst case scenarios that they were positing a few years ago. The British journalist George Monbiot, who's written a couple of books on climate change in the last few years, wrote an article the other day saying that in his conversations with climatologists around the world, they're quietly saying it's too late. We're completely screwed. We've missed our window of opportunity to do anything because governments around the world have been just dragging their feet. In Australia, in the last couple of weeks, the federal government has started talking about their emissions trading scheme, and it's been met fairly negatively across the board by business and environment groups, and everyone's slamming them. So I wanted to get your take on some of these things as somebody who's closely involved. Let's start with the projections.
Let's start with the projections. Okay. I mean, the projections are real, and the consequence of not doing anything is as bad as these people say. So I'm not skeptical about that at all. But these people are what I call, it's too much management and not enough leadership. The manager projects the trends and says, my God, what do we do about that? The leader part of each of us goes into the future and says, what would I like to create and how do I create that? So if you project the trends, they're all grim. And the entire scenarios of these people are based on the fact that they are projecting trends of increased emissions with more power stations, particularly coal-fired power stations and more cars and more middle-class people doing this and that, and not making a reasonable kick at... If we rely on reducing emissions, all those prophecies will come true. Simply because when you start reducing emissions, there's always vested interest against the reduction of emissions, and they're often extremely powerful with the ear of governments and with lots of money to spend. So you're taking on a very hard thing to try to reverse, getting a person who's made all their money out of processes which... have high emissions to say, well, down the track I'll reduce them, but I can't afford to do it now because it's a recession. But the real problem is not the amount of emissions. The real problem is the amount of carbon dioxide that's actually in the atmosphere already and our projections about what will be added to that, okay? You know, you only have to go back a few years. It was now about 300 parts per million, and now it's going up to 450 and maybe to 500, depending on how gloomy your projections are. And people quite correctly say... At that time, you know, the heat will swell the water, the sea levels will rise, maybe some ice caps will melt, we'll have more extreme weather events and all those predictions. What has been left out, however, is the fact that we can do the other thing is directly remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
We can remove it from the atmosphere?
I call that mining the sky. It's like a gold rush. Imagine a gold rush in the 19th century. There was a bit of gold and a lot of quartz, and there was a value on the gold, so people went and pegged their claims and fought for the gold. Now, if we put a price on carbon in the sky, say $40 a ton, everyone say, well, that's a valuable commodity, which is a little bit of carbon and a lot of oxygen and nitrogen and so on. How can we get it out? Now, there are... and this is dispersed carbon, if you like, what's called high-entropy carbon. Carbon that's been split into single molecules. We have two four carbons, concentrated carbon as in coal, and dispersed carbon. Now, we're going to have to explore the possibility of maybe having different prices on two kinds of carbon. So what we have to do is create a market initially for dispersed carbon to pull it out of the atmosphere, and that's what forests do, and that's what agriculture, plants fixing carbon in photosynthesis does, all those sorts of things. So there's an existing place for that. Indeed, the whole imbalance is caused by the fact that there's more people emitting than the old systems of fixing carbon. So the whole thing is not in dynamic equilibrium anymore.
Can we build enough forests to pull it out?
If we only use forests, then the answer is probably no.
Right.
But there are a whole lot of other things. What we should think about generically, thinking about how do we take carbon out of the atmosphere. Now, there's a whole lot of ways we can do that. First, the biologically based things, which we can make a lot more productive, including some industrial ones. For example, we can use algal farms to harvest carbon dioxide.
Algal farms?
Farms of algae.
Oh, right.
In ponds with high volume farms, which can be driven and driven with circulation of driven by solar power, we can fix, and that can fix, so there's biological systems like that. We can turn that into a whole set of products to protect them. One very good one is biochar, which is concentrated carbon, which we can put out in the soil, which will stay there for 100 years and create great agricultural productivity. It also will hold lots of moisture, so we'll actually be able to grow wheat in biochar-added soils, which perhaps have 30% less rainfall than currently because we've added to the carbon dioxide. So we can continue to produce products, agricultural products, in lower and uneven rainfall. So there's a big upside in the agricultural productivity side of that. So there's a whole lot of biological systems, biochar, making compost. But the problem is we're not encouraging this to happen because we don't have a big price on carbon. So... But my view is I still mine the sky, because what if all our mining companies got into this and started mining the sky? In other words, they saw this as just another mine to pull carbon out, because carbon is now valuable. Now, there's a new pile of new technologies which are coming down the line. One of them I'm actually involved in, which involves a big tower, often up to a kilometre high, and you put ocean-sprayed water on the top and it falls. It collects huge amounts of speed as the heavy air falls and generates 600 megawatts of sustainable energy, renewable energy at the bottom. We export 300 megawatts of that into the grid and use the other 300 to actually put electric currents, basically electrochemical currents through the seawater in there and take the carbon dioxide out and turn it into limestone. So we produce limestone. Now, that's a feasible option. Now, they're expensive, but the important point is if we get the sums right and we have a price of, say, $40 a ton on carbon, I think it's very feasible. And suddenly there'll be a whole lot of massive investment in sky mining.
What do you do with the limestone?
Well, limestone's a valuable product. As a matter of fact, everyone says everything's getting too acid. Acid, the oceans are getting acid. The perfect stuff is limestone. That's what you use. And so you can and agricultural soils are becoming acid.
Uh-huh.
So the whole world is becoming more acidic because of the excessive carbon in the atmosphere. So there is a big market for limestone, a bigger one. And also we can actually change the pH or the alkalinity around coral reefs and that sort of thing, so we can actually protect the carbon, the corals for longer, because the excessive acidity we can neutralise in a regional basis. Now, there's a lot of other biological systems. One of my favourite ones is what I call ocean enrichment. I put some urea or some nitrogen fertiliser in a whole piece of the sea, and there's this huge product inversion in phytoplankton and zooplankton, which creates more fish, so we get a bigger food supply of fish, and we pull all that carbon out and we compost it after people have finished eating it, so we're actually pulling more carbon out of the sea because more carbon is being fixed in the sea and turned into more fish and to more algae. So we're making the whole sea more productive. The sea is a huge reservoir of productivity, and people are concerned about the fact that even our so-called buffer, which means you hit it with acid, it has a capacity, it's resilient against acid dumping or alkaline dumping, but over time it's getting more acid, and what that means is that it's a less habitable place for a biological system like coral reefs, which are based on limestone, for example, and fish and a whole lot of other things. So what we have to we can actually start keeping the carbonic acid or the carbon levels down in the sea by taking them down and pulling it out as productivity fish. So we're pulling out stuff, some out of biochar filled soils as wheat. We're pulling out fish out of the sea in ocean enrichment. We're pulling this directly out of the sky in this technology which can remove. Now, these are all on the drawing boards. I'm actually personally involved in one of them. I know it's and that the entrepreneurs who are involved in this are working with me on marketing this. We've already shown it to the Chinese, for example, and the Chinese are showing some interest in it. So while we continue to focus on reducing emissions, getting all these vested interests, what I call the brown interest, the vested interest of the unsustainable present, versus the green interest, which I call the vested interest of the sustainable future, and they're at war. So, but the fact is, the vested interest of the unsustainable present might be interested in making money out of carbon in the sky. So we're changing the whole dynamic. So the mining in the sky option is a very serious one to me, and we need a lot of capital for that. But all our capital is going into cleaning up dirty coal. Now, if, for example, for every molecule coming out of a coal-fired station, we take two out of the atmosphere, problem solved, doesn't matter. So there's this big soup of up in the sky, which includes too much carbon. And so what we have to do is get the dynamic equilibrium between the amount of carbon going in and the amount of carbon coming out. Now, all the carbon taxes and the cap and trade schemes are designed to do that, but they're all focusing on giving emissions, not paying directly the people. So my view is what we have to set up is a large trust fund, probably to subsidise for 10 years at a slightly high, artificially inflated price, say $45 a tonne. So we need a few billion dollars to do that. Put that in a trust fund. And the first people who get into the sky and mine the sky successfully make big money, okay? And because we're basically subsidising it through capital markets. And we say, look, it's all in our interest because it's cheaper to spend the money there than spend the same amount of money on carbon reduction. And for taking all those vested interests on, hedging, and all the politics, and the politics are convoluted, as we're seeing in Australia now. You know, the vested interests of the brown interest, and even the super green interests are both dumping on the cap and trade schemes because they think it's inadequate. I think that's wrong, and I could go and talk about that in a minute. But the important point I first want to say is the Mining the Sky option is a serious option, and while we just think about reducing emissions, we're going to panic and say, oh, my God, we have to stop emitting. There's up there that's a reservoir in the sky. If we can start pulling carbon dioxide out by a whole new set of industries, which are carbon harvesting or carbon mining industries in the sky, we can get the dynamic equilibrium back. And I think so I actually wrote this article and predicted by 2038, the world was panicked because of sky carbon, because the number had got too low. Because so many people were pulling out of the sky that people were worried about global photosynthetic rates would be going down. The so-called what are called C3 plants, which are very sensitive to carbon dioxide. And those are levels going down. I said, so we hadn't have a treaty which we agreed on the optimum amount of carbon we have to keep in the sky, which is just enough for the photosynthesis to work, not enough to endanger the climate. That's probably around the 300 parts per million, which is where it was before the Industrial Revolution, and that's the way we evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can get back to the pre-Industrial Revolution, so to the levels of carbon in the sky circa 1760 or 1770,
mm-hmm.
when Australia was settled, just interestingly enough, mm-hmm. think about, we can probably fix the problem. So what we have to do is work a way to get carbon in the sky down to 300 parts per million
by
sucking it out as well as slowly working on putting less in. But we have to do both. But so it's slowing the emissions level but also pulling more out. There's very little discussion on this except people say, well, there's a few forestry and we can use those. And people are now talking about biochar a bit. But there's no – what we need to create is a big market for dispersed carbon in the sky.
Hmm.
And if you get paid more money for pulling it out of the sky than actually slowing down the emissions.
You're using capitalism to try and solve the problem, right?
In a nutshell,
How do we make this profitable? So why isn't there more discussion about this, Peter?
It's actually it's interesting. I think this is to do with the way we plan our future. It's too much management, not enough leadership. The manager's position is what are the so the futurist part is two people. One is the prophet, what will be, and one is visionary, what should or could be. And George Bernard Shaw said that beautifully. Some people see things they are and ask why. Others see things they could be and ask why not. So everyone's saying, my God, the projections are going up. We have to reduce our emissions. So we focus on reducing emissions. So that's a trend line which we're going to reduce the trends because they're negative. We actually have misconstrued the problem. The problem is not the cause is too much emission in the atmosphere. The problem is caused by too much carbon in the sky already. And what we have to do is directly attack that and pull out by a whole lot of ingenious ways. Because I say to me, put a $45 a tonne price on dispersed carbon in the sky, the capitalist market will say, my God, this is a way to print, make lots of money. And the human inventiveness and the human innovation will go in that direction. It's not.
What do they get for carbon coming out of the ground, for coal?
Well, it depends on the price of the price of carbon. But it's a very concentrated form of carbon, you see. I mean, it's just the cost of production plus a margin.
So you're saying that the price that you're suggesting that we would pay them for pulling it out of the sky is about the same as what they get for pulling it out of the ground?
No, a bit more.
Because they have capital costs.
That's right. What we have to do is we have to give them a guarantee. I mean, the way I would do it, if I were constructing a carbon market, would say I would get a whole pile of financiers to put a big slush fund, a big capital fund, to say, for 10 years, we're going to lose money on this. We're going to subsidise this, and we're going to provide great rewards for the first people to get into the sky who actually start pulling this out and converting it into a useful product like limestone, for example, which is a marketable, tradable price you can actually sell, or into biochar, which can stay in the soil forever. Now, on the other side, you can actually lower emissions, and there's lack of imagination on that too. Everyone worried about baseline power, and they say, well, the only baseline power that works is coal or nuclear. The simple fact is, what I call marine hydro is important, for example. And we can have solar marine hydro or lunar marine hydro, which is basically moving water. I remember about a year ago, I was off the northwest coast of Tasmania, a place called Cape Grim, which I worked on putting a baseline monitoring station for carbon dioxide there many years ago. And I looked out to sea, and there was about 500 metres offshore, there was a rock, and there was a half-metre bow wave on that rock. And I asked people, I said, oh, it's there 24/7. And the amount of water going through, this is solar-driven currents. It's both tidal and solar. The amount of coming out of the Southern Ocean through Bass Strait into the Pacific Ocean. Now, you start adding up sums about moving water, the amount of power you can generate by just dropping turbines into moving water is staggering. Now, I just use that as one example. There are many others, all the geothermal, there's many others. And that will happen over time.
And are people working on that?
Yeah, lots of people are working on that.
Right.
The more important thing, though, is everyone's going into a panic stage now. And what we have to do is deal with the high levels of anxiety to say we have to directly attack the amount of the sky carbon levels and get them down. So we have to literally mine the sky for 20 years or 30 years. And we have to set up a climate regime and a market for dispersed carbon in the sky, which can be used for 20 years. And by that time, the price of carbon will stabilize by itself. So what we have to do is create an artificial price for dispersed carbon in the sky initially. And we say, we spend so much money on that. And given the opportunity costs of this money, if you don't want to think about the cost of moving 125 million people in Bangladesh because the seas are rising. To name one example.
Yeah.
And you can go around the world. The costs of not doing nothing are astronomical. So this is a preventative strategy. It directly works on pulling carbon out of the sky.
Now, Kevin Rudd came to power and, one of the themes of his election campaign was taking the environmental situation a lot more seriously than the Howard administration. They're, a year and a bit into their government. Do you think that they're making sufficient progress?
It's very hard. And people are knocking them because they only have a 5% on the 2020. I want to talk about that a bit because they're criticised for that. But they're still keeping on a 50% by 2050 and perhaps even up to 80%, which has been discussed in the last few days. So I want you to imagine a curve which is flat at the beginning. So basically our carbon reduction strategy, which is flat at the beginning and gets steeper and steeper. So it's a curve which is a logarithmic curve, if those people know a bit of mathematics. And the big reductions are in the last 10 years between 2040 and 2050. That would be the Australian model because we are a coal-dependent economy. On the other hand, France is a nuclear-power-dependent economy. They can make big reductions now and they can plateau out. But by 2050, we will be at the same percent reduction, whether it's 50% or 80%. I think it's probably get better than 80%. I actually think that's very achievable. But people are making totally unreasonable demands on the fact we should reduce Australia's emissions by 20% by 2020. That's very possible in Europe because they have a lot of nuclear power. It's very hard in a coal-dependent country like Australia.
But the report...
But by 2050, we'll have caught up. That's the important point. We just have a longer lag time. So people seem to think we need a straight line trajectory for reducing carbon all the way up to 2050. It can be a curve which can go upwards or a curve that can go start high, start very steep and go flatten out and plateau out.
But this isn't the report that Kevin Rudd commissioned himself. Who was the guy who put that together?
Ross Garnaut.
The Garnaut report. Mm-hmm. Didn't he call for 20% emissions for Australia by 2020?
He did indeed.
And that was Australian specific.
No, that was. And that can be done. Now, we can argue about how dislocating that is, economically dislocating. With the simple fact is we do have a recession on. So it's a bit hard to know. He did call that, and his modelling suggests that's plausible. I'm not sure he's right. I would like to think he's right, but I actually don't think it matters. Providing we get to 50% or 80% by 2050, it doesn't really matter where we are in 2020 because as long as we have the long-term trajectory, because the real damage will be done. But in the meantime, while we're doing all of that, which we do, we can start pulling carbon out of the sky tomorrow. By having an entire regime, so we're actually at the worst buying time and at the best fixing the problem completely, depending on the dynamics of carbon in the sky, how much is entering and how much is missing. But at least we're committing ourselves not just to wait for nature, natural system of forests and things and rangeland, which, by the way, in Australia could be huge amounts, things like mallee tree farms. The mallee tree is very interesting because the mallee tree is a dream come true if you're interested in sequestering carbon, because most of it's under the ground and a bit else above the ground, and it grows in very low rainfall, 10, 12 inches by the old thing, and it's a harvesting machine. Even if you have a bushfire, most of it stays beneath the ground. So one of my solutions is to plant massive mallee farms throughout a whole lot of rangeland Australia, and use the natural rangeland. If you do your sums on the amount of photosynthetic capacity of Australia's rangelands, it's huge. And I have scientific friends who tell me that Australia's rangeland can fix enough carbon to fix our local problems completely, and that's a mine in the sky option. It's pulling carbon straight out of the atmosphere. So what we have to do is put a value on dispersed carbon. So right now, agriculture and rangelands are not even part of the equation. So we're focusing on coal mining and clean coal on the industrial system. Simple fact is we have to deal in agriculture for biochar and compost, for direct fixing of carbon. A lot of the mine in the sky options are in rural Australia and rural communities around the world. But there are some industrial things like these algal farms I talked to you about, these algal industry farms which can produce massive amounts of food and biological material which can be either composted, it can be turned into biochar, it can be turned into food, it can be turned into cattle food. I mean, we're making a lot of food industrially. And those things, we put one on the side of a power station now.
So are you aware of much discussion happening in Canberra around mining the sky as an option?
When I've talked about it, most people glaze. I said, well, it's all too hard. We can't put agriculture into the mechanism. So the mechanism is a lot of people are becoming neurotic about that mechanism because it seems directed at the coal industry.
Erotic?
Neurotic.
Right.
And the important point about that is leaving out agriculture. And all the solutions which are mining the sky solutions based on agricultural or industrial plants which harvest carbon directly from the sky are being left out of the equation. So we're actually making it harder for ourselves to convince Australia to go this route. And the vested interests, as we're seeing, are relentless and powerful and will never stop because, as far as they're concerned, is they don't care about their children or grandchildren at all. They just want to make sure they're here tomorrow.
How is that possible? I mean, I'm as big a cynic about corporate motivations as anyone, but how can the people running these companies not care about their children or their grandchildren? That seems hard to fathom.
A lot of my clients, I often ask people who are big head of big corporations like that, because I have a lot of my clients are big corporations. I said, look, the year is 2050, and your grandchildren and your great grandchildren are standing beside your grave on your birthday. How are they remembering you in one sentence? I talk a legacy conversation. None of them want to see that they kept their companies in cash flow. What they want today is that they actually want to be married to leaving the planet a better place for their children and grandchildren and for others than they found it. And that's a natural human trait. It's no accident that there are lots of people who made money by quite difficult ways and illegal ways in their early career, set up big foundations at the end of their career to hand money back because they actually want to remember it. And Bill Gates is a good example of that. But the Rockefellers.
Andrew Carnegie.
Carnegie. All these people who some would question some of their business methods during their business days can't fault the fact that the Rockefeller Foundation alone is a force for good. And people forgot about how he earned his money because he...
No, they didn't. We still remember how we earn his money.
Anyway.
Let's talk about something else for a second. I was thinking of you last night. I was reading my Fidel Castro book, the recent sort of quasi-autobiography that was put out a year or two ago based on a series of interviews done with him by the editor of Le Monde magazine. Mm-hmm. And there was one line that Castro said that I thought, that's a Peter Elliard line. Castro said something about, to paraphrase, he said, we have to get to a point in human evolution where we stop thinking of ourselves as a group of nations fighting each other and we think of ourselves as one people on a planet and we think about the planet first and the survival of the species first and our national interest second, because he said something like the survival of the human species cannot by any means be taken for granted. And I thought, wow, he's talking about planetism.
That's right.
It's a Peter Elliott line.
Well, that's exactly right. Nationalism. Well, you might remember John Howard said, "We're not our former prime minister." For those people who are not in Australia, who said we're not going to sign the Kyoto Protocol. It's not in the national interest. But I say yes, but it is in the planetary interest. And sometimes we have to determine is our primary allegiance to planet or to nation. under those circumstances, any thinking person will say it has to be to planet first and nation second. That's the order. Now, I think, so we're not nationalists anymore. We're what I call planetists. And there's a whole set of values that go with it, nine of them, which I describe in Designing 2050, as you know. But the important point about that planetist perspective, when you say, well, we have to actually celebrate our nationhood in ways which celebrate the fact that we're members of planetary society. Just 2 weeks ago, I was at the WOMAD Festival in Adelaide. A beautiful, all these wonderful groups from all over the world singing basically tribal music in a single concert. And everyone was celebrating. It was all of humanity singing tribal music in the context of global unity and the unity of humanity. And that's a classical postmodern feature of planetism. We can actually celebrate our nationhood. And all that music, a lot of that music was about our tribal nature. Even it was often written at times when we were war with neighbouring tribes.
Mm-hmm.
But now we celebrate it not as separate concerts for different nations, but as a single global concert. And you go into what I call these world industries. You go to a world food hall, you go in and there's all these different cuisines around the outside. You can get the first course of Czech and the second course Siamese or third course Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's celebrating the difference of food. Now, 25 years ago, to eat all other people's food was an act of tribal treachery.
Yes.
We've moved on. Now, planetism is like that. First allegiance to planet. And this is partly what all this debate's about. People have corporate interests. Some people have corporate interests. Some people have national interests.
Yeah.
But more of us, and we're the educated middle class of the world. And there's about 1.5 billion of us. And it's going up very fast thanks to globalisation.
I often wonder what my great-grandfather would have thought if somebody had said to him just after World War II, 1946, if somebody had said, 50 years from now, your great-grandchildren will be eating sushi twice a week and, the big Japanese part of their cuisine. It would be all very, very
Japanese. Says it all, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, they would have been horrified.
That's right.
Absolutely horrified.
That says it all, really. Mm. And the fact is now we are all, John Donne said it beautifully. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is part of a continent, part of the main.
I want to talk to you. This is the other part of the chat I wanted to have with you today. Obviously, since the last time you and I caught up to do a podcast, there's been two, I guess, very significant events happen on the global stage. Barack Obama becoming president of the United States, very significant for a number of reasons, but also the global financial collapse. And, I know that one of the things that we've talked about before and you talk a lot about in Designing 2050 is how globalization is actually a positive force for the human race and not a negative force. As many of us that read, alternative left literature have been educated to believe. But we've just seen, a very dramatic we're starting to see the beginnings of it anyway. It's probably going to get a lot worse, of the effects of this massive push for globalization, these large corporations and the banks and the insurance companies, potentially launched the planet into another Great Depression when we should be, enjoying ever-increasing wealth, not going backwards and everyone worrying about a Great Depression. What went wrong?
Well, the important thing about globalization is it's constructed interdependence. And interdependence means that we actually now, our fate depends on what other people do,
right.
Whether that's trade, whether it's the environment with Kyoto Protocol and all the successes, which is the World Trade Organization, whether it's dealing with terrorism. The simple fact is that we are all interdependent here and one person's act can damage us. Now, a good example of how things have changed was that in Australia, we banned cigarette smoking in cafes 10 years ago. And we said a smoker in a cafe is a pariah because that provides collateral damage to us. By 2020, a person who smokes on the planet and puts climate-changing gas in the atmosphere will become a pariah in the same way a smoker in a cafe did in 2009. Now, so interdependence means that we're all involved and we all, so a few greedy people on Wall Street, of course, the destruction, and a few hedge funds supporting them and a few banks who got a big break from George Bush with a statutory deposit ratio and could lend a lot more money against their assets, created this problem. And they've brought us all down. Now, I think what's going to happen on the 2nd of April in London at the G20 is people will say, never again. This has been such a horrific thing. Last time the greed is good thing wasn't both in 1986 and later, 10 years later in the Asian one in 96, took a part of the world. But this time we're all affected. We're all on one side and we're all suffering together. So when we go to the G20 meeting in April, on April the 22nd, we're either going to triumph together or we're all going to fail together. We'll all win or we'll all lose. And there are three big issues. One is, how do we get the financial system, banks lending and taking all those toxic assets in? I think that will be fixed. The second part of the question is, how do we prevent people putting them down protection barriers out of national interest and keep the whole globe open? So that means we have to get the Doha round of global change up by the end of 2009. I actually think that will be done too.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought there's some fairly major blockages to...
There are, yeah, but self-interest...
The non-aligned countries are really pushing back against IMF conditions.
That's why the G20 is so important, because it has places like Saudi Arabia and South Africa and China and India at the table bargaining. And that's the big change. Going from the G8 to the G20 is an important thing, because the kind of people around the table now are the 85% of the world's economy. Now, if we can get them to sign up, the rest will come. So, and the third area, of course, is the whole, we've got the Doha round, we've got the climate change issue. So we have these three things. Interdependence has caused the climate, the financial meltdown. Interdependence is the one form of interdependence is civilizing globalization, or creating a Doha round which actually looks after people. And that's about 50% completed. And the third area is the climate change. So we have these three huge global issues, all which are on... for discussion in London on the 2nd of April, with 20 key people constituting 85% of the world's GDP. Now, each of those people are going to have to decide, each of those leaders, am I going to be at this moment a planetist or a nationalist? Which my choice is? And which is my interest in my nation? Is it to take the short-term narrow interest, or the more, if you like, or the narrow self-interest, or the enlightened self-interest, which says, my country will benefit more by opening up trade, not putting on protection barriers. My country will benefit more by working to solve, not cooperating with on the climate change issue. My country will benefit more if we take out all these toxic assets together. The same message. There's a very critical meeting on the 2nd of April. I would suggest the most significant beating of country national leadership since the end of the Second World War.
And you think, and you're optimistic that they're going to take
I'm very optimistic. We won't do it all in one hit, but they've already suggested there's going to be another meeting in Korea a bit later. But the conversation has started. And if you look at the website of the G20, it basically says fixing the financial problems, fixing the climate change, giving the poor a chance. See, because globalisation is the way to uplift poor people. I mean, globalization is immense. It's created a booming middle class. And the middle class in India and China alone is 550 million. And the educated middle class of China plus India alone until this year, which, of course, is going backwards, but until this year, has been growing at the population of Australia annually, 20 million each year. Now, global middle class people think more or less the same. They think, I believe in democracy, I believe in a clean environment, I want two kids, not 12, and I want them to go to university, and a whole pile of other things. That shared value system is shaping the planet. So I'm actually confident down the track that this would be a beginning of a historic change. So I think by the end of 2009, we'll have fixed up the Doha round, or almost. We'll actually go to Copenhagen, which is happening in December also, very big time, the end of this 2009, to say we have to actually have a post-2012 process in place. And we will actually have to kickstart the banks so they actually start lending to people, and we should start pumping up the economy. Now, the other important thing to remember is this time around, this is the equivalent of an invasion of Australia of the world from outer space. We're actually all on the same side. We're facing a common enemy, which is the creation, in each case, of our own past, unenlightened past, plus the greedy people in our midst today. But we all have the same enemy. We all have the same problem. And then we have to either all win together or lose together. Now, I cannot see a scenario where basically every one of these people knows if I put up my national interest first, I know we're contributing to the fact we're all losing. And after all, that legacy conversation is, when I cease to be Prime Minister and President, how will people remember me? They stymied the climate change issue, or they stymied the toxic asset issues, or they made a mess of it. I can't see it. People actually, each of us has the capacity to be noble and big, I actually think we're actually getting to the point now that choice is very stark. And the stark, the contrast of the danger is back to when 30 years ago when we were put into two divided camps facing a Cold War and a nuclear winter, and we stepped back from the brink. But there were two sides. Now there's just one side. And the side is our own, we've created this mess for ourselves, and we have to clean it up so we can live successfully today and our children can live better for the future. I think it's very clear. So I'm actually very positive.
But, you know, John Howard and George Bush, you know, had this same motivation. You would think about how their future generations will remember them, and they didn't seem
to. They were unremitting nationalists. They said national interests come first, not planetary interests. Obama and Rudd are much bigger thinkers than that, to name those two people. They are basically essentially, but it doesn't mean they have to ignore national interests, but they have to persuade their own people to do the noble thing while the planet is actually in the best long-term interest of their nation. That's not an easy thing to do when you've got people screaming from the sidelines like the coal industry.
But I haven't seen either Rudd or Obama, you know, get on the television and say those words. No. Why not? Why aren't they getting up and saying, you know, we need to put the future of the human race first and our own national interests second for a little while here?
I think it will happen between now and the 2nd of April and right through the year 2009. I'm very confident because ultimately that's the big challenge we face. Now, that doesn't mean we have to spread the pain around so we can all gain. And that means, and Garrett Hardin said this beautifully, the story of the here and now with all those three big issues, the climate, the trading system and the financial system is what forms of mutual coercion can we mutually agree upon? Now, that was said by Garrett Hardin in a famous essay in the 1960s called The Tragedy of the Commons. It has never been more true today. What forms of mutual coercion can we mutually agree upon? And that's what the 2nd of April and the G20 is about.
Peter Elliard, designing2050.com. Any Australian bookstore, people can go in now. They can order the book. It's out there. It was launched by the Governor of Victoria a couple of weeks ago. Went very well, I believe. I couldn't
wonderfully
make it.
Well, yeah.
Thanks for chatting with us, Peter. It's
a pleasure,
delight,
my friend. Always,
always
a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks.